DIY vaccines, groups of scientists going their own way to try to develop new tools to combat the pandemic, but is it legal or ethical? That and more today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown, more on DIY vaccines. Also, Dr. Fred Campbell of UT Health San Antonio back to answer more questions from listeners about COVID-19. With renewed scrutiny on longstanding racial disparities, the spotlight turns to interpreters for the deaf in Texas. And 75 years after VJ Day, how veterans and a Texas museum dedicated to the war in the Pacific are marking the moment. Those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this first day of September 2020. And there's nothing like September to strike loathing in the hearts of many a youngster with the end of summer blues. But that was back in the days when things were more like normal. Some young people, isolated for the better part of the summer, are eager to get back to their friends, although many of them will be doing so virtually as schools reopen online and in some cases in the real world, albeit tentatively. For the most part, though, school officials are hoping that remote learning will help curb the spread of the coronavirus, and that has created more than a few problems on the home front, not just from parents trying to work from home while watching over their kids, trying to get and stay connected. For many, there's also the issue of getting connected in the first place. Now, you'll recall back in the spring when schools were first shuttered and learning went almost completely online, teachers and administrators struggled to keep students from falling behind, but they were having to develop systems that were effectively cobbled together. The promise was that the pause of summer would allow most schools to catch up and be better prepared for back to school, virtual school that is, in the fall. But the fact is that as the new academic year gets underway statewide, thousands of students are being left out altogether, unable to make the connections that are critical to get an education under these current conditions. So reports Aaliyah Swaby for the Texas Tribune on this Tuesday. She joins us now. Aaliyah, welcome back to the Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about what you are finding. One Central Texas school district, 7,000 students struggling to access virtual learning. What's the story there?
So Killeen ISD started off virtually, and they realized that they weren't reaching, their estimate was, you know, between 5,000 and 7,000 students were not able to connect for some reason or other to the virtual learning system. And they had ordered more devices for students who didn't have them. I think there were just under 1,000 students who didn't have devices. And that shipment potentially wouldn't arrive until October because there are supplier backlogs. So that means that they had to open classrooms for in-person instruction a week earlier than they planned because just students were not able to be educated.
But part of the problem isn't just a lack of devices. It's an ability to actually get online, right?
Right. So there are areas of the state, a lot of them rural. I focused on the border regions of the state where, you know, the infrastructure just isn't there for good internet. I talked to the administrators at San Elisario ISD, which is right next to the border, just outside of El Paso. And families who were given hotspots complained that their hotspots only worked sporadically, and they're really used to the signal being stronger sometimes on Mexico's side of the border and finding it difficult to find internet service providers who can reach them. So it's also infrastructural issues that, you know, sometimes are not easily fixed by just, you know, throwing computers at the problem.
The state launched an initiative called Project Connectivity, which you write that the state is contributing hundreds and millions of federal stimulus dollars to. We're talking about those computers that you mentioned, the hotspots that you mentioned. The backlog apparently is not that officials didn't know that they would need these devices. It's actually in the supply chain, right?
Right. So the Operation Connectivity Program, as of mid-August, they ordered around 1 million devices and hotspots for more than half of Texas's school districts. In mid-August, the estimate was that some would take as many as 16 weeks to arrive. And that's because of districts across the nation are facing the same challenges right now. Yeah. You can't just look at this as a Texas issue. Everyone wants laptops. Everyone wants hotspots. And so there's shortages across the country.
Now, we should point out, and you were talking about those who couldn't make the connections. They didn't have the equipment. They didn't have the broadband. Is it correct to say that we are talking about mostly lower-income Texas students being affected the most here?
Yes.
Is it known how many? So how many students are we talking about? Is it known statewide?
It's hard to pin down what that number is statewide. I think, you know, there are districts that started off at a disadvantage because they already were not one-to-one in terms of devices for every student. And so now they're districts that are poorer, they're districts with students who have more needs. And some of them, I talked to the superintendent of Mercedes ISD, where they can just manage a device per family, whereas you have other districts that can have more than one computer or iPad for every student. Districts are starting off from very different places. And I think, you know, the point of the story is that it's patchwork right now. There are some districts that are doing way better than they were in the spring. There are some that are, you know, still really struggling to keep up and to reach all their students.
Read all about it over at texastribune.org, where Aaliyah Swaby is reporting on an issue in education that is quite serious across the state. Aaliyah, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Let's shift gears a bit and move to your questions about COVID-19. Throughout the pandemic, we've been taking questions from listeners just like you and posing them to Dr. Fred Campbell. He's a doctor of internal medicine and associate professor of medicine at the Long School of Medicine, UT Health San Antonio. Dr. Campbell, welcome back to the Texas Standard. Good to have you with us.
It's good to be back, David.
This question comes to us from listener Brad Emmons. Brad asks, transmission is all about the air breathing in someone else's cough or sneeze. As a vector, contracting via surface is considered a low probability. Given that, why is there so much emphasis on hand washing?
The listener has a very important question, and one that needs to be, I think, addressed specifically. There is good reason to believe that hand washing over the last century and a half has been extremely good for reducing microbial contamination. However, it's also clear that COVID-19 is predominantly a respiratory infectious agent, and hand washing, although in general is a good idea, probably has not been as effective except in situations where someone is in direct contact with a known COVID sufferer.
That's very interesting. And just to be clear, hand washing is a better agent at fighting the spread by contact than the use of some of those alcohol-based sanitizers, right?
It is very, very effective. And alcohol, although it's very good, is not necessarily any better than good, thorough hand washing with soap and water.
Christopher Dombrowski asked this on our Facebook page. He says, has it been determined yet whether someone that has contracted COVID-19 and recovered can catch it a second time within a few months? And if that has not been determined after months of study and over 23 million confirmed infections, well, why not?
The medical experts have, in fact, confirmed patients with recurrent COVID infection that apparently are normal, do not have serious immune problems. So I can tell you that, yes, it is possible to have a reinfection, and we're not exactly certain why that happens. But it could conceivably have something to do with the amount of neutralizing antibodies in someone's system. Again, research is going to have to continue on that particular topic.
This next question comes from a listener named Melissa, who asks, do we know if there are any incentives planned for businesses to improve HVAC systems, HVAC systems, to pump fresh air in and indoor air out instead of just recirculating air that could be carrying virus, or maybe to add UV lighting or filters. Is there any research to indicate this is even helpful or not? Maybe we should focus on that second question first, Doctor. Any indication that this UV technology she's talking about might limit the spread of COVID-19 from what you know?
What we do know is that sunlight, which has UV rays and artificial UV, has been effective in inactivating infectious COVID-19. What we do not know for sure is how effective other kinds of techniques, such as filtration or what we call laminar flow rooms or other kinds of ways of affecting the air around us, is going to be in terms of reducing COVID infection.
Would it be helpful to have businesses upgrade their HVAC systems to pump fresh air in and get the stale indoor air out, or no?
Theoretically, that would be a beneficial thing. However, I cannot with any certainty at this point in time point to evidence that it is reducing the transmission of COVID-19. I think being outside in general is very important because of the UV light. I think that may be helpful. But again, some of the more specific techniques of trying to reduce the amount of COVID-19 in the air have not been proven effective yet.
I haven't heard anything about incentives for businesses to upgrade. Have you heard anything along those lines?
I think unless we have good evidence to prove it, I would not expect that to be a big push at the present time.
Dr. Fred Campbell is a doctor of internal medicine at the Long School at UT Health San Antonio. We've been having him join us regularly over the course of the coronavirus pandemic to answer your questions. Now, if you have something you'd like to ask, look for us on Twitter, Facebook, or go over to texasstandard.org/coronavirus. There's a form there to submit your questions. Dr. Campbell, thanks so much for joining us again. Good to talk with you, sir.
Yeah, it's always great to be with you.
And great to have Wells Dunbar join us once again. He's monitoring the talk of Texas on this Tuesday. Howdy, Wells.
Hi, David. Some serious news circulating on social media today. President Trump on Monday declining to condemn the suspected 17-year-old shooter of three protesters against police brutality in Kenosha, Wisconsin, that shooting leaving two people dead. NPR reports that the president claimed without evidence that it appeared the gunman was acting in self-defense, Trump telling the White House press corps, in part, "I guess he was in very big trouble. He probably would have been killed." His remarks sure to inflame the situation ahead of a planned visit to Kenosha today over the objection of local officials. A heated conversation unfolding on social media, including our Facebook page there. Carolyn Kresik Liss asks, "By failing to condemn this sort of vigilante violence, is Trump now encouraging children to take up arms? Does anyone actually think it's acceptable for 17-year-olds to be wielding AR-15s? Just one of the comments we're seeing out there, David. I'll be back with more later in the program.
You know, I don't know whether you've heard about this. New York Times has an interesting piece today on DIY vaccines. We're going to be talking with one of the editors over the MIT Technology Review about that as the Standard continues.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Artificial intelligence is more than a booming industry. It's raising a lot of possibilities for managing long-term issues like weather and the environment. Now, two institutions of higher learning in Corpus Christi have partnered to establish one of the nation's new centers for AI, as Lon Gonzalez of KEDT reports.
In what's being described as a historic milestone for environmental science, a collaboration between Texas A&M Corpus Christi and Del Mar College in Corpus Christi, along with the National Science Foundation and other federal agencies, is an investment of over $100 million to establish one of seven national centers to develop artificial intelligence, or AI. The partnership between Texas A&M Corpus Christi and Del Mar College is headed by the University of Oklahoma. The local team is supported by $3.2 million over the next 5 years.
Now, that will fund a lot of students. That will allow us to push the research in AI, push the envelope, and those are fantastic resources to continue our research there.
That's Dr. Philippe Tissot, interim director of the Conrad Blücher Institute. Dr. Tissot explains that the AI aspect is not the robotics area one would normally associate with artificial intelligence, but would be used to gather information vital for the environment.
When you have that much information, a lot of it goes unused. And so artificial intelligence allows you to make a better use of all of that data. And you come up then with better predictions for navigation, for flooding, for sea turtle conservation. There are just a lot of possible uses.
Del Mar College computer science professor Dr. Philip Davis says the community college is the only institution its size involved in the venture, which will develop part of a new AI certificate, a 5-class sequence of courses for advanced jobs in technology. There will be opportunities for students in this new level of research.
Part of what the mission of this local AI institute for the Coastal Bend, this is what we're doing. We're doing the risk communications and environmental science part of it. Emergency preparedness, Texas A&M is specifically looking on coastal functions in any sort of coastal marine environments.
One of the goals of the AI Center is to better predict and understand things like beach inundation and sea turtle nesting. The overall outcome of the research will hopefully serve as a role model for other institutions as the AI field continues to grow over the next decade. In Corpus Christi, I'm Lon Gonzalez.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Right now, there are some 36 different potential vaccines for COVID-19 currently in clinical trials, according to the latest data from the New York Times Coronavirus Vaccine Tracker. Of those, 9 are already in large-scale efficacy tests. But even with the FDA's recently announcing that it would be willing to fast-track a vaccine, large-scale administration could still be months away. Some scientists are taking matters into their own hands by making their own DIY vaccines and testing it on themselves and peers. But that approach is raising questions about safety and legality. It's something that Antonio Regalado has been covering for MIT's Technology Review, where he's senior editor of biomedicine. Antonio, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Great to be here.
You know, I think that a lot of people hear DIY and think there are certain projects that are particularly well suited for such an approach, building a shed out back, perhaps doing quilt or something. From the sound of it, it sounds like some kind of alternative medicine people are cooking up in their kitchens, but obviously none of that's right. Who's behind these vaccines and what exactly are they doing?
Well, we don't actually always know who's behind them. I've found about 4 or 5 different groups that are developing DIY vaccines. They are scientists. They're people who work in the biotech industry or in some corner of academia, and they do have, you know, the skills to make molecules, proteins, and other components of a vaccine. And so these are the people who've just taken it upon themselves to make a vaccine now and inject themselves, or in some cases swallow it or spray it up their nose, because they don't want to wait for the official version.
Why are they doing this beyond the fact that, what, impatience? I mean, you have more than, what is it, close to 36 different potential vaccines, as I was mentioning earlier. Is that not enough in their estimation, or what?
You know what? I think to ask whether it makes sense is the wrong question. They can do it. They can do it. And I think they want to demonstrate that they can do it. There is a movement in biology, and it's sometimes called DIY biology, where the idea is to, you know, take these techniques out of the labs, out of the big labs, company labs, and kind of let anybody do this type of work. So in a way, the vaccines that they're making are a demonstration of this trend.
Who are they developing these for? You mentioned that there are groups doing this, that this is not necessarily just individuals, but people who are doing this in collaboration with one another? What do you mean?
Yeah, they're kind of groups of scientists that have gotten together. It's sort of a friends and family operation for early adopters. A lot of the people, the vaccine that we wrote about, which is called RadVac, came out of some people who are attached to Harvard University. And you know, it's kind of a thing that early adopters might be interested in, just in the way that if you're in technology, you might be the first to download an app or to try some new program. These are people who are at the cutting edge of biology, and they simply want to be first.
Well, this isn't the cutting edge, it's the bleeding edge, isn't it? I mean, it's one thing to work on technology. It's quite another where you're using actual human beings as part of your experiment. Isn't this extremely dangerous?
Some bioethicists raised a complaint about these DIY vaccines, but it wasn't so much that it was dangerous to the individuals involved. In fact, it's more likely that their vaccine, you know, is like a sugar pill and does nothing. The danger that they saw was the skirting of the FDA and regulation, because if people don't trust the vaccines against coronavirus, that could be a problem, right? We want a vaccine that's approved, that's gone through all its steps so that people do take it, and so we can end this pandemic. As soon as there's a DIY effort, it just throws in a cloud of confusion. You know, is it real or is it not? Nobody knows.
Does this speak to a larger problem within the development of vaccines? And I guess I would also wonder, sort of as an ancillary question to that, if more and more people involved in this field decide that it's okay to give it a go themselves, in a way, is that not a Pandora's box?
It could be. I mean, we're talking about sort of do-it-yourself biologists in their home laboratories making vaccines and taking them. But there's also entire nations, China, Russia, possibly the United States, which are also endorsing vaccines that have not been fully demonstrated to be effective. Russia said they have a vaccine. They're going to start to distribute it. China has been giving a vaccine, again, unproven, to people in key industries. And you've heard President Trump talk a lot about wanting to get an emergency approval for a vaccine before Election Day. And that time frame means that vaccine will not have been shown to work in the usual way. So the difference between these DIY biologists and the state-sponsored vaccines is quickly diminishing.
We've been talking about DIY vaccines with Antonio Regalado. He is senior editor of biomedicine at MIT's Technology Review. We'll link to his latest at texasstandard.org. Antonio, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks a lot.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton is suing the state's most populous county over its plans to send mail-in ballot applications to more than 2 million registered voters. The lawsuit filed Monday maintains Harris County's effort to expand absentee voting amid the pandemic violates state election laws. The Republican argues the applications would be delivered to voters who are ineligible to cast absentee ballots. State law restricts voting by mail to citizens who are 65 and older, disabled, or will be outside their home counties on Election Day. Texas is one of a few states in the U.S. not allowing more people fearing COVID-19 to vote by mail. The Texas Democratic Party is suing to expand the option to all voters. Meanwhile, Texas Democrats are also aiming to contact 1 million unregistered voters in the state this week ahead of the November election. KERA's Brett Jaspers reports.
The deadline to register to vote in Texas is October 5th. Early voting starts the following week. Luke Warford is with the Texas Democrats. He says through phone calls and text messages, they'll direct people to a website to get the registration process started.
We know people don't have a printer, so we print out their application for them. We know a lot of people don't have a stamp or an envelope, so we send them a postage paid pre-addressed envelope.
Warford said there's no master list of unregistered voters, but they're using data sets of people who've recently moved and consumer data to find people to contact. He didn't give a goal for how many they hope will follow through with registering. The Texas Democrats say it's their biggest week-long registration effort in history, and they'll target younger voters and voters of color. The Republican Party of Texas didn't respond to a request asking about their registration goals. I'm Brett Jaspers in Dallas.
Starting today, about 90,000 women enrolled in the state's Healthy Texas Women program can receive new enhanced postpartum care services. Houston Public Media's Sasha Kortner has more.
The goal of HTW Plus is to help improve the overall health of mothers and babies. Coverage will include help for asthma, diabetes, and tobacco use, which experts say are all linked to improving the state's maternal mortality rate. Postpartum depression and substance abuse are also covered.
And more information on services can be found online at healthytexaswomen.org. And a volunteer firefighter from North Texas has died while helping battle a wildfire in California. The Crescent Volunteer Fire Department near Fort Worth announced the woman's death on Facebook, but did not provide her name. The firefighter was working for a private contractor on a series of fires in Mendocino County, California. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the online UT High School, offering a full-time diploma program and a variety of individual courses, including for advanced placement. Learn more about options for the new school year at highschool.utexas.edu.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. The Black Lives Matter movement continues to focus attention on longstanding racial disparities in the United States. Now interpreters for the deaf in Texas are addressing the lack of diversity in their field, where 87% of interpreters nationwide are white. Texas Standard intern Sarah Gabrielli has more.
From 1887 to 1965, Texas schools for the deaf were segregated. That's 11 years past the Brown v. Board of Education Supreme Court decision, which was meant to integrate all public schools. And during that time, different dialects developed between the black and white deaf communities, just like they develop in spoken language. Professor David Quinto Pozos teaches linguistics and sign language courses at UT Austin. He says one of the most common ASL dialects is called Black American Sign Language, which is still used in Black deaf communities today.
Just having those separate schools before, I think, lent itself to, you know, the development of features of a language, of a variety of a language that are slightly different than other features that are used in another school.
For example, to apologize in mainstream ASL, you would press a closed fist to your chest with your palm in. In Black ASL, you would press your fist into the opposite side of your chest with your palm facing out. It's a similar meaning, communicated in a slightly different way. It's the difference between the phrases I'm sorry and my bad in spoken English. The use of different dialects in communities of color is just one of the reasons why the Texas Society of Interpreters for the Deaf, or TSID, is investigating the lack of diversity in the interpreter field.
The interpreting community is heavily female and heavily white, as opposed to the consumers that we serve, deaf people who are obviously of every race and of every gender. And so that disproportionality does a disservice to the deaf people, and that's what we're working to resolve.
Whitney Giselle Douglas is president of TSID. The group invited everyone from the Texas deaf and interpreter communities to propose an action plan for the group moving forward.
Through this, we were able to uncover some pieces of anecdotes of interpreters of color feeling marginalized or feeling that they didn't have the same opportunity for gainful employment that white interpreters had, for example.
Frank Perales is part of the small community of Hispanic interpreters in Texas. He says it is important to improve access to education and testing for people of color. Most interpreters need to get a bachelor's degree and pass the certification test.
Here in Texas, we have court interpreter certification. Not everybody has that. There's a lot of prerequisites that you have to do in order to gain that certification. But I can tell you the majority of those individuals who have current court interpreter certification are white. It's very, very rare that you find a person of color who has court interpreter certification.
Perales is Hispanic. When working with Hispanic deaf people, he can tell they're excited and relieved to see him. And this goes beyond understanding their dialect.
There's a lot more meaning and a lot more impact when culture is shared between two people. And when you have a third party that's trying to relay that communication, trying to facilitate that communication and make that bridge, and they are not of the same culture, it makes things harder. And it makes things almost sometimes awkward.
For deaf people of color, this dynamic can be more than awkward. It can be deeply discouraging. Trying to communicate the nuances of their feelings and reflections through a white interpreter. Growing up in Fort Worth, Texas, Pinky Collie only ever had two black female interpreters, one in middle school and one in college. But she never questioned why her interpreters rarely looked like her. She just thought they were supposed to be white and rich. The following is an excerpt from Collie's written testimony about her experience with interpreters in Texas. I was always misunderstood and underestimated growing up as a deaf black girl tomboy. I try to voice more often when I am at a discomfort level with the particular interpreter, especially when they demonstrate my attitude, tone, and articulate vocal differently from my actual intention. When Collie moved to DC in 2013, she says she found a much more diverse pool of interpreters. In Texas, the Society of Interpreters for the Deaf is looking at several ways to bring more people of color into the profession. Some of those ideas include waiving membership fees and conducting all TSID business in ASL. For the Texas Standard, I'm Sarah Gabrielli.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, reminding everyone to keep annual preventive and screening appointments. Early detection is critical to better cancer outcomes, so discussion with a doctor is encouraged. More at texasoncology.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Let us pray that peace be now restored to the world and that God will preserve it always. Those words spoken by U.S. General Douglas MacArthur 75 years ago this week, words marking the end of World War II. The original recording of that speech, along with many artifacts of the era, live in Texas, in the National Museum of the Pacific War, also known as the Nimitz Museum. Rory Cartier is director of the National Museum of the Pacific War in Fredericksburg. Welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hi, thank you very much for having me today.
You know, I've seen the museum, and I think it's safe to say one would normally expect a museum of this caliber to be in D.C. I mean, after all, the National Museum of the Pacific War. Why Fredericksburg, Texas? And tell us a little bit about the Nimitz connection.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the Nimitz connection is why we are here in Hill Country, Fredericksburg, Texas. You know, Admiral Chester Nimitz, he was head of command during World War II in the Pacific. So the original museum actually started out in his family's hotel. His grandfather actually opened a hotel here in Fredericksburg, Texas in the 1860s.
Wow.
And this is where Nimitz grew up. And then the citizens of Fredericksburg really wanted to open up a museum honoring Admiral Nimitz. Eventually, he gave his permission to do a museum here as long as it focused on the men and women who served under his command in the Pacific.
And it's a big place, 7 floors, and I understand recently renovated. What all do you have there?
So we cover the entirety of the Pacific War in the theater of the Pacific, the Asiatic Pacific. So we cover everything. Actually, we start a little bit different. Our museum is a little bit unique. We actually start with what we call the seeds of conflict. So we go into the history of the tension and the conflicts between China and Japan. And then as the world gets smaller with technology, we see that global conflict growing. And then that leads us into eventually Pearl Harbor and then America's involvement in the Pacific War. And then we have a separate section called the Pacific Combat Zone, and that we have some of our larger artifacts, our macro artifacts over there, such as a PT-309, and then we also have a TBM Avenger, which is the same type of aircraft that President George H.W. Bush flew during his time in World War II.
You know, one of the things, and this is pre-COVID-19 I'm talking about here, one of the things that our family enjoyed when we visited the museum was just how interactive it was. As I understand it, this was a museum, one of the first, I gather, that actually encouraged guests to sort of interact, right?
So we do, and we did. One of the things that I really like that we do during our living history programs is we do what's called a kid pack. And that's where we actually bring a kid up from the audience. We place a pack on him, a pack that typically a soldier would wear, you know, a backpack with all of his equipment. And we start loading it down so they can feel every ounce of weight that these men and women had to carry with them as they went through the war. And that gives them that connection that otherwise they can't make.
But it's not just kid stuff either. I mean, for people with disabilities, there's a way to enjoy and appreciate these exhibits too.
There is. And that is true. We do try to keep that connection alive. And that's something really where the audience can see, hear, smell, feel what that experience was like.
You must have met a lot of the veterans who have come by to, I guess in a sense, witness and re-witness, re-examine their own stories. That must be moving for you.
That is incredible. This place in general is incredible. I know people back in the day, they were the high school seniors. They were the young kids going out there and doing this stuff. And that's still how they see themselves. Very few will take credit for anything they did during the war. Most of them, the majority that we meet is, I did my job, and I did what they asked me to do, and that was it. And it's humbling. It's a truly humbling experience to talk with these men and women.
Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we did the Alamo.
Rory Cartier is director of the National Museum of the Pacific War in Fredericksburg, Texas. One of those young men Cartier was talking about was a student when the war started. This is his story.
My name is Jack Maroney. I was a 16-year-old freshman in the fall of 1941 at the University of Texas. And December 6th, I had the privilege of watching the University of Texas beat Oregon in football 71-7. So for some reason, that number sticks in my mind. And the next morning, I got up, and the place was absolutely in bedlam. We're war, and somebody was hawking newspapers. Now we all anticipated we might be at war pretty darn soon, but not in the fashion that we got surprised and slaughtered there in Pearl Harbor. In early March 1943, I sent to San Diego for boot camp at the Marine base there. And it's a huge, maybe the largest Navy base on the West Coast, I'm not sure, but certainly one of the largest. And the Enterprise, of course, is the most decorated ship in World War II. There were 21 battle stars issued by the Navy, and Enterprise had 20. And I was on there for the last 12 of those battles, including all of the kamikaze period, which continued to the end of the war. I think all of us at that point in time wanted to join the military, whatever branch, to be able to help our country in any way we could. So the honor of it, hell no, not much honor being shot at, and kamikaze trying to kill you, there's no honor there. So we weren't thinking about honor. It was a privilege, and I with great pride that I served. I was discharged as a corporal in the United States Marine Corps, and some years ago, I had the honor of being another stripe to be an honorary sergeant. I had tears in my eyes then, and I get tears in my eyes now. Well, after the war, I went back to school and became a lawyer at the University of Texas Law School. And by the way, I'd been kind of had an item with a girl before I left, and she loved me dearly. It took her almost 6 months to get married to an Air Force officer, so I didn't. I was freestanding, and I called this Joyce James to ask her if she'd like to have a Coca-Cola. I'd take her down to the drugstore. On Navy Day, October 27th, 1945, instead of being with the Enterprise in New York, Joyce and I walked down the aisle in Oak Cliff Christian Church and became man and wife. And in 2 months, we'll celebrate our 75th anniversary.
World War II veteran Jack Maroney. In observance of the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II, the National Museum of the Pacific War will be hosting a series of virtual events starting tomorrow. They're free and open to the public at pacificwarmuseum.org. We'll have a link at texasstandard.org. You're tuned to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. When the pandemic began in March here in Texas, daycare centers and schools closed, meaning many families lost childcare. It's been a real headache for parents and caregivers to have their kids at home while they work from home or leave to go to work. KUT Austin's Claire McInerney reports this issue isn't just a challenge for these caregivers. It's actually a bigger problem for the whole Texas economy.
On Friday, March 13th, Chase D. Anderson sat in the conference room at her office. She and her colleagues at the Children's Defense Fund had just been told they must work from home starting the next week, so the staff was meeting to discuss how to make that transition. Daily life was about to become unrecognizable in many ways, and for Anderson, one of her biggest challenges of the pandemic began that day.
My kids are right there, yeah. They were in the room with us in my office because I didn't have anywhere else to put them, so.
Her 6 and 7-year-old daughters were with her because the Austin Independent School District had abruptly canceled school that Friday. Soon, the city would order everyone to shelter in place, and she and her husband would be asking, what do we do with the kids? Obviously, they weren't the only people asking this question. Childcare has been a huge stressor for so many families over the last few months. But this is more than a logistical nightmare for families. It makes David Fagan really worried about the Texas economy.
The picture changes every day, but I'll say the last I heard, we had around 30% of Texas childcare providers were closed, and many, many more are on the verge. Many of those providers may never reopen.
Fagan is a policy associate at Texans Care for Children, and he views these centers being closed and financially struggling as dangerous to economic recovery. Because if kids have nowhere to go, then working parents have a much tougher time getting back to work.
And we're cognizant of the fact that there's pressure on them to return to work, both for their own personal needs, basic needs, and by their employers.
That's Jason Gindell. He runs Main Spring School, which is a nonprofit child care center that serves mostly families that are low income. And it's been closed since March.
I get an email, every day from a family member asking if we're going to reopen soon.
He hasn't yet, because the high infection rates and hospitalizations of COVID-19 in Austin this summer have made him wary. As cases have leveled off, he now plans to open September 8th. But finances are top of mind. He's been able to pay his staff thanks to a good savings account and a PPP loan. But once he reopens, he expects only 50 to 75% of the children to come back. And even though he'll have fewer children, he'll stay fully staffed in case someone gets sick and needs to quarantine.
And so that creates an upside down financial situation for us, right? We are suddenly under-enrolled, and so our income is going to be down.
While Main Spring expects fewer students when it opens, the pandemic has forced some centers to turn away students. Latrice Jones is the assistant director at Open Door Preschool East, which has been open since April. Her organization didn't let all students come back. They figured with fewer students, that would mean less exposure to COVID-19. It does make her sad to know that they are denying families childcare and likely putting them in a hard financial position.
if we can't get childcare settled out, there's not a business that'll be able to last very long.
Jones says childcare centers need more money from the state and federal government so they can hire more teachers and bring more students back while also keeping them safe. In Austin, the city is starting to discuss this kind of support. Stephanie Hayden, the head of Austin Public Health, sent a memo to Mayor Adler and the city council asking for financial support to childcare centers. Her memo asks the city to give $12 to $15 million for one-time expenses to keep these providers afloat. In a previous resolution from the city council distributed $1 million to childcare centers. If there isn't more support, though, across the state, Fagan worries limited options for childcare could mean some parents will just stop working, which also hurts the economy.
How many parents are just going to decide they're better off quitting their job and not returning to the workforce because they can't afford to send their children there or they're afraid to?
Which is exactly where Anderson, the mom we heard from at the beginning, finds herself. The last 5 months have been difficult with two working parents and two school-aged children. She and her husband had a conversation toward the beginning of the pandemic and decided she would be mostly responsible for the kids during the day.
When one person earns a lot more than the other person does, you make these decisions. Like, if one of us is going to lose their job, if one of us is going to struggle at their job, it's not going to be the person who can support us, you know, on his own.
Now that her priority is to help her kids with school and not devote the same amount of time to her policy work, she does worry if she'll eventually lose her job. In Austin, I'm Claire McInerney for the Texas Standard.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar is our social media editor monitoring what Texans are talking about online. What are you seeing out there, Wells?
Hey, David. Well, we've been talking a lot about issues surrounding voting in this upcoming November election. We heard a lot about that on yesterday's show, including the story about how Harris County plans to mail-in ballot applications to everyone in the county, and some of the controversy that has engendered. Well, now we're hearing from the governor via Twitter. Greg Abbott, he tweeted that Texas sues Harris County to stop it from sending all voters applications for mail-in ballots. The governor adds, by law, only qualified voters who ask for mail-in ballots can receive them. Harris County's scheme can lead to voter fraud and compromise election results, the governor tweeted, including there a link to the Texas Tribune's reporting on the subject. Interestingly enough, one of those Texas Tribune reporters, Alexa Ura, she tweeted in response, as we've pointed out multiple times, the state itself lets any voter request an application for a mail-in ballot through its website without asking whether the voter is qualified or meets the eligibility requirements. Some additional sort of context for that tweet from the governor calling Harris County's plan into question. This from Mike Hixenbaugh, now with a reporter with NBC News. He tweets that he feels like the wording in this tweet is deceptive. Harris County is doing this thing. Now here's the section of state law that's not actually being violated by this thing. Now, here's what could happen if Harris County's thing really did violate the law. So interesting back and forth here with some reporters shedding some additional context, shall we say, on the governor's tweet as this battle over what voting in November is going to look like continues, David.
I think that a lot of people, or I have seen some people, I should say, not a lot, but I've seen some people raise questions about how much confusion there might be, especially among older voters who get an application in the mail and don't know what that actually constitutes, or is, you know, if you get something in the mail that's unsolicited from the county clerk's office, are they saying, here you go, it's okay to vote by mail because there's been some change in the law? So the confusion factor is, I think, something that's out there that is being discussed. But it'll be interesting to see how this thing sorts out, especially as we are now closing in on 60 days before that election date.
So close.
It's just amazing. And still, a lot of confusion among a lot of voters about who can vote where and how exactly. Of course, it's only one of many stories that we continue to track here at the Texas Standard, and we would love to hear from you, too. Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar is looking for you, as always. Keep up with the news 24/7 at texasstandard.org. And, of course, we hope you will join us again tomorrow.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.